Welcome. I just want to let you know about these various things that I have upcoming. For one, in May, I have mini workshops on the weekends coming up. One is how to start and sustain a practice on your own, which is not so easy if you've tried it, right? And then there's also one about the philosophy, how to extract the philosophy from your practice, the yoga philosophy. And that's going with these asana principles that I teach according to the 7 asana principles. So it's a really interesting little mini weekend with detailing these principles, but then also the yoga philosophy that gave birth to those principles. And then I'm also in Europe at the end of May for several stops, and including in London, I'm going to be doing a second series, Mysore Intensive, second series and intro to third. So, and the intro to third is for kind of a wide look at it, at the poses of third. There's some good ones that almost anyone can do that as a regular practice. And then lastly, I have this subscription that is ongoing. It's called the Asana Kitchen subscription, and I put in weekly new editions of short forms and drills and pranayama things. And so if you're interested in that, I'd love to have you join in on that. So anyway, one question somebody asked with Tara, which is I would say it's a lifelong central question of practice. It's like, it's not an easy answer, and it just stays with you your whole life and your whole kind of practice world. It has to work with this question, and I call it I call it different things, but right now I'm thinking of it as a house. So it's your outer house and your inner house. And when you practice, when you step on your mat, that you're attending to your inner house, right? There's so much to it that, and then the rest of the day, you're dealing with your outer house, your work and your relationships and your children and your parents and all of these things. And so basically Tara, she asked me, what's the funny thing about it to me is that if you think about a spiritual path or spiritual dimension to your life versus a kind of material dimension, and the world is, in yoga, it's known as Kali Yuga, the fourth age, or there's 4 ages, and they're likened to throws of a dice, like when you gamble. And in the first age, when you throw the dice, your chances of success or like winning are very high. But in every age, it keeps getting worse and worse. And the fourth age that we're in is the worst throw. and what it means is that to have a spiritual life or the valuing the spiritual ideals and really placing focus and emphasis is not happening, right? So it's a challenge. The spiritual dimension is really underrepresented, whereas the material dimension is very well represented, right? And emphasized. And so often then people find though emptiness or something, or like something's missing, right? That you can even have a very nice material life with all the, you know, good job, a good home, good family, friends. You can have all of that, and still it's not, there's something missing, and that can really take you down or make your, have pain and suffering and angst and real challenge, right? And so people find their way to some kind of spiritual path, a yoga or something, right? And but what's less imaginable but equally valid and happens particularly within Ashtanga and like strong spiritual practices or strong disciplines is that you, it's almost like you over-represent the spiritual part. You become very obsessed with your practice and needing to make sure that it's got all the dimensions. And so like Tara's telling me that like she doesn't have enough time for the asana practice and the pranayama and the chanting and the studying philosophy and this is a real source of distress, like feeling angry and like a failure, real challenge, right, with this. And so I'm going to talk to you a little bit about it. So one thing, here's one thing I want to say about it, all right, which is there's one aspect to that, wanting to do it all, right? Like, it's like in some ways we can fantasize like, I don't know, like a monk, or like you'd have your cave and then you would have time for your asana practice, and then you'd move on to your chanting phase where you pulled out your harmonium for 2 hours, and then you, and your sacred texts would be there, and so you'd read your Upanishads and write, and you'd have your journal and you'd write, and then you'd also have your kind of it's interesting in those Vipassana retreats, they have, in some ways, it's like the ideal setup. So they have the group hall, right, where everybody can gather and sit together and there's satsang. And then they have this whole section of individual cells. So you go off by yourself, right? So that's in there too. It's like your kind of individual time of meditation and retreat and solitude, and then you're coming into community and sharing with the spiritual dimension in a collective way. And all right. And so, but this doesn't happen. Not at all, right? You're lucky to get an hour. A two is a unbelievable 2 hours a day to devote to practice before all the other responsibilities and things that you have got going out there in the outer house, and so in one sense the guilt or the anger that you're feeling, Tara, it's like a noble way. It's like you're trying to be a good yogi, all right? But in another way, I'm sorry, I'm going to put it this bluntly, it's just plain greed. Yeah, it's greed, people. You understand, you can't do everything, all right? This is a reality, and you don't need to. Okay? And thing is every person has to decide What's the priority? What serves me the best? Which aspect of yoga it calls to me the deepest, the most, and makes the biggest difference in my life? And for me, I've been through what you're talking about, or I go through it. I'm not just been through it, but I recognize that greed in myself. And I have like two Kirtan albums, and like I went deep into bhakti yoga and playing the harmonium and mantra chanting but what's interesting to me is I always have circled back around to this asana practice being the core of my practice. And it's because it does the most for me. If I really choose, like, this is the best. And it's interesting how my teacher, he said, Ashtanga yoga is all including. Okay, and this is so cool. This is really something, there's wisdom behind that, you see. And it doesn't mean, because usually you hear me talk about that, and I say that it's all including, you know, like asana, pranayama, bandhas, like it has all the hatha yoga components. But it extends beyond that. It has all components. It's sometimes frustrating to me that we think that, like, that people actually ask, like, where's the devotional aspect? Like, they really want or need to chant or play or do these things. And to me, it's like, well, if you have the 6 hours a day or the 10 hours a day, then great, do it. But if you don't, well, then you've got to work with what you have and prioritize and and it's all there. You see, you don't have to do all of those dimensions to be a good yogi, right? In fact, it's better to do one thing really well, I think, than to put yourself off into here and over there. Although, everyone's different. There, some people, maybe they do a little bit of asana, a little bit of chanting, a little bit of philosophy. And you can make that choice. But you can also not do those things and still go all the way with yoga, right? It's not that you have to have a formal Sanskrit study to do yoga or to come to the realized state or whatever it is that you're trying to get. And you know, I go by that saying, which is not just a saying to me, it's an experience. The discipline and the philosophy are one and the same. You understand what it's saying? That it says the learned know that the discipline and the philosophy are one and the same. And so, the ignorant think that they're separate. Okay, so your philosophy is not over there in some other study. No, it's right there in what you're doing. But here's something I want to tell you that my teacher said too, which is so amazing. He says yoga is, it's 1% theory, 99% practice. Okay, so you do want to crack open those sacred texts, 1%, a little bit, right? And you do want, like, to take a Sanskrit course or some chanting or just look at the texts and have that other way of absorbing the information. So, like, yeah, the discipline and the philosophy are one and the same, But it sure helps if I've read the Bhagavad Gita and it says yoga is skill and action, and you have the right to your action, but not the fruits. So skill in action, that's vinyasa. Then I can really apply myself to that with a clear intention and with the knowledge of how it's connected to yoga philosophy, right? And so there's a give and take in there, right? That you, Tara. So sometimes you go for 10 days or something and you immerse and you do that lot of yoga, lot of inner house time. Or it could be on Saturdays, it's inner house time. Saturday mornings or whatever it is, right? But then you're satisfied and you're thankful that I got those 2 hours and wow, I made a good use of them, right? And on the other side of that equation, see, yoga, I feel like there's a certain mentality where the inner world and the outer world, they're mutually exclusive. That like the outer world is the enemy of yoga, and you're always trying to, the outer world is just this illusion. It's all false, and you get attachments and aversion, and you have to devalue that, right? You're trying to let go of that and live a spiritual life. And this to me is not at all the spirit of yoga, and it's a very unnecessary distinction to make. Okay, so to me, you can look at life has such a rich spectrum of beautiful experiences, beautiful things that you can be involved in and know and experience and love and be in relationship with, right? And you can say that just so each dimension, the material dimension, the spiritual dimension, they have their shadow side, okay? And the shadow of the material world with greed and, all the what gives rise to the kleshas, ego, egoism, attachment, aversion, and things that give rise to the yamas. So violence and stealing and dishonesty, all of these shadow elements of the material world are so well noted, and we can experience them in ourselves so easily. Okay, but also there's the best of the spiritual, the material world. There's love and relationships of all kinds, friendships, sibling. Father, children to parents, and partners, right? Husband, wife. So these relationships are to be experienced in this life, equally to any of the best of what the spiritual dimension has to offer. Okay, work in this world, in the outer world. This is essential and wonderful and not to be missed in this life. So you're not making one world against the other. They're feeding each other, these worlds, that you go into your inner house to be better in your outer house. It's all very, like the ultimate life is to have deep, meaningful place in both of these dimensions, right? And you have to, and like I started this off with, it's an ongoing thing. That this question or this balance or this negotiation, it's constantly going on. And everyone's different. Everyone has different ratios and then different phases, different feelings, different wants, right? And so it's very important that you pay attention within yourself and enter into that dialogue with yourself and that negotiation and listen to yourself. And when I said that it's greed, that's the sort that there's an element of greed behind wanting to do it all. It doesn't mean you shut down that voice or that part that's like, no, I want to chant. I want to do philosophy. I want to do the asana, right? It's fine. But is it realistic? And then what is realistic? And what really fits when that committee, the menagerie within gets together and like sorts stuff out?
Okay, I have two questions for you. You can choose whichever speaks to you. The first is just the story of how you started teaching and I guess like pivotal moments or challenges throughout your teaching experience. And the second is how you think Ashtanga yoga needs to evolve, if at all.
So you guys, I completely cringe when I think of my teaching beginning. Oh my God, I'm blushing. So I'll tell you two stories. Number one is, so I got kind of pushed into teaching before I was really ready, and so somebody convinced me to substitute for them, this class, and the other thing is I did, before I tell you that, I've left it behind to a large degree, but not entirely, but I was horribly shy and just terrified to speak in front of a group of people. And it still challenges me, but not like it was debilitating before. And like I did some teacher trainings with Adil Pakiavala, who's an important teacher for me. And you'd always have the 5 minutes during the training, you'd go up in front of the group and teach a pose, 5 minutes or whatever. And me, I never did it. I just like skipped that part. And so that's one thing. I just was a chicken. It's funny, sometimes I joke with myself and I go, my name is Scared E Cat. Scaredy Cat. So somehow I got convinced to substitute for this women's class. And like, so she had all these regular students too. And so I don't remember exactly what happened or how this happened, but so we get in there, start doing the class, and somehow I just completely lost it. Like 100% lost it. Like, I couldn't even talk. And you know, like, It's just even hard to go back there. It was so awful, right? Like, and everybody's just sitting there in a yoga class, like going, oh my God. And then also, I do remember this funny thing about teaching. This was a little bit different, but I taught at Outward Bound some when I was younger. And when I was learning, I was an assistant on the rock climbing. I had this mentor. I loved this guy. He was so cool. He was Tony Kantakos, that's his name. He was an old timer at the Outward Bound. And he always had these really meaningful things behind his rock climbing talks. So he's like doing the yoga of rock climbing. And so I got to teach one session early on, and he was watching and everything, you know. And I started off by telling them that something like, yeah, I've only been rock climbing for about a month. And afterwards, he was like, yeah, you know, I don't know if that's a good lead-in thing. These guys are there with their ropes and stuff, and the instructor's telling him that, you know. So anyway, and this yoga class, like, that's another thing. It's like, so you're quaking and you're nervous. You don't break character. You know, you just got to bear through it and, like, deliver the instructions. But I didn't do that. They ended up, like, actually coming over and, like, hugging me and stuff. Like, it's okay. In a yoga class. Okay, and then... I didn't stop substituting from that. I somehow lived through the trauma, and they convinced me to substitute some more. And so I was really into, I had this teacher, Marie Svoboda, that was into the crouch and spring, basically. Her whole thing was about, it's how you get into the pose that was important, so that being in the pose was not as interesting to her. And so I was working with this group, and we were doing handstands at the wall. And like, I was just like, I don't know if you think I have a lot of energy now, but imagine me at like 26. Yeah. So it was just like totally full on. Well, yeah. And like, and so this one girl, she was a younger woman. She was slightly, a little bit overweight. But she was doing those handstands just like everybody else. And then a couple of weeks later, I did the class again, and she comes back, and she told me she turned purple after that, her face. And she went to the doctor and everything. And she was like, not bummed. She was like, she was back for more. But she turned, her face turned purple and like stayed that way for a while. And I was just like, oh my God, right? And so these are my beginnings as a yoga teacher. And unfortunately, there are more stories like that. But I mean, none too bad or anything, but it's quite, you have to be quite thankful. Even, it doesn't matter how long you do it too. You have to be so thankful to the students for putting up with you and helping you to learn, because that's what it is. It's a very high-skill job that, I mean, and some of the skill, you can't get it in any other way than teaching, right? And of course, you practice seriously and you train and you do your best. But also, Angela, one other thing that I did I did it somewhat by accident, but somewhat very intentionally. And Yeah, the accidental part was pretty amazing, actually. So in India, when I would go to Mysore, I started studying music there, and there was a duo of teachers, these really awesome young guys that had just come to Mysore, and they were just starting teaching. And I wanted to learn the tabla, right? And so I started studying with this tabla teacher, but his friend and the guy, they came together to Mysore, was a singing teacher. Okay, and so I ended up playing tabla, and I would, this guy, he didn't have a lot of discipline, the singer, and I did. So I ended up playing tabla for him for his singing practice. Like, I'd go over to his house and wake him up after I did my yoga, and then he would sing and I would play tabla. And like sometimes his friends would come over and he would have to explain in the Kannada, the language, that, see, like if you can, I don't know if you can see me, but I have this finger. It's from skateboarding. It's a distorted, it bends like completely up, like your finger does not do. Okay, and this finger is key. It's called the grip for playing tabla. So basically, if you have this kind of finger, you're screwed for being a tabla player. And so my singing teacher, he got so fed up with my tabla sound because of this finger, and he goes, you're going to learn vocal. He's like, you vocal now. And I went, okay, let's do it. And like, and if you know Indian vocal music, like, I'm not a very good singer, and that was ridiculous that I was going to learn vocal. But I did it. And I really got into it, and I made a soundproof room for myself. And that room was just big enough for me and a harmonium and a tambura. He couldn't lay down in it or anything. It was like a cell. And but you couldn't hear me. And so I went in there and basically found my voice. Like, I overcame my shyness. I didn't ever become a good singer, but I was able to speak in front of a group of people with the full force of my voice. And so I do recommend that if you're going to be a teacher, you make sure you can use your voice and make a practice that allows you to do it. Because you want to be free in offering your guidance and sharing what's inside of you. Okay, so there's that. There's a few things. There's more, but a few things. As far as the evolution of Ashtanga, yes, you asked that, Angela. Does it need to evolve? And yes, and I have been offering my input for decades, and I feel that everything that I teach is, part of it, it's a plea to Ashtanga to evolve. and there's just so many aspects to it that that need addressing. I'll hit on a few of them. Okay. So one thing is that, so here's, and this is a kind of a larger picture idea of it. Okay, so to me, you've got, here's how I see it. So you've got yoga, right, is the big umbrella. Yoga itself. Okay, and then you've got, there's four branches under that umbrella. And there's Hatha yoga, bhakti yoga, karma yoga, and jnana yoga. So there's four branches, right, of yoga. And then within hatha yoga, within that, there's hundreds of branches, right? And Ashtanga is one of those branches of hatha yoga, all right? And so what Ashtanga is for is it's not an end of itself, that you're actually doing Ashtanga yoga. So, okay, before we say that, let's just break this down. So yoga then is it's a perspective, right, on the world, or it's a consciousness. It's consciousness in a way, right? And that's all it is. It's this idea that there's a spiritual dimension and a material dimension, and you're trying to learn to identify with that spiritual dimension that is other than the material part. Although we just had that whole conversation how they're interlocked, right? Interconnected. But, okay, and then hatha yoga is designed to give you the experience of yoga, all right? And what is hatha yoga? Well, and you could say it's many things, right? And this is the thing about yoga itself. It's hard to define what yoga is, actually, right? And that's partly why there's hatha yoga, is because, and in fact, that's how the Hatha Yoga Pradipika starts. It says that it calls the greater yoga Raja Yoga, which is like royal yoga, right? And it says because the meaning or what defines Raja Yoga, because that's so difficult to define, there's so much darkness around it, then the author of the Hatha Yoga Pradipika has presented this Hatha Yoga to shed light on Raja Yoga. Okay, so then what is Hatha Yoga? And if you take those four chapters of the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, you get a pretty good idea of what Hatha Yoga is. So it's asana, pranayama, mudra, and samadhi. So it's these postures, Hatha yoga, it's breathing techniques, it's bandhas and mudras and these things, and it's focusing, mind focusing, samadhi, dhyana techniques. Okay, but so within that, that's broad. That's like, wow, it could be thousands of postures, thousands of breathing techniques, thousands of these things, right? Enter Ashtanga yoga. Ha 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 ha. So what is Ashtanga yoga? Well, Ashtanga is a particular set of asanas, a particular way of approaching pranayama and breathing. And bandhas, all those setup positions, inhale, head up, those are bandha generating positions. And so what you've got then is it gets more and more specific. So what hatha yoga is, that's like, where do I start? And what yoga is like, okay. But Ashtanga yoga, it's like Surya Namaskara A, come, inhale. Standing poses, first series, finishing poses, right? Okay, but it's like Alan or the Zen are, don't mistake the finger pointing at the moon for the moon itself, right? So Ashtanga, its whole purpose, people, is to teach you hatha yoga. It's to teach you about asanas, pranayamas, mudras, and samadhi. It's not supposed to teach you this set of poses in this order done for your whole life. No. It's supposed to teach you how to do this broader category, this more general thing, so that then what your interpretation of asana or pranayama is based on that you learned Ashtanga, but then you set yourself free. You move up the chain. And you benefit from what you learn from Ashtanga greatly. Okay, but then that's not all. Because your asanas, your pranayamas, they're trying to lead you to yoga. And yoga is not postures or pranayama. It's not breath control. It's not being able to do triangle pose per se. All right? So just that mentality right there, Angela, right? It immediately takes you out of this kind of rule-following rigidity that you find in Ashtanga, right? Let me see. Somebody's weighed in here. Let me see. Okay, he's saying, I hear much emphasis on the importance of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras and Hatha Yoga. Nevertheless, this practice is a Tantra one, isn't it? It can be said that Patanjali proposed a soterology based on the annihilation of human mind. In samadhi, the person disappears and infinite divine emerges. In my opinion, Hatha Vinyasa Yoga encourages the opposite, remaining human with their own senses to balance prana, gaining more awareness and living authentically as a person. Yes, but you see, here's the thing. I go by this saying all the time. I'm not sure how to pronounce your name. I'm sorry about that. If I try, it'll really mangle it, but I'll... Ania. Oh, no, he raised his eyebrows. Damn. Ania.
I'm Italian.
Okay. So anyway, I love this statement from Richard Bach, the author of Jonathan Livingston Seagull and Illusions. I love this saying. He goes, argue for your limits, and sure enough, they're yours. And you see, me, those Yoga Sutras, so yes, you can see it that way, and maybe it is that way. Like, and if you're very logical and rational and scientific about it, but me, I'm more poetic about it, or even practical in a way. And I read those Yoga Sutras, not just the three that are about asana, because people do that. They go, "There's only three sutras about asana in all of the Yoga Sutras," and that's that's like a proof that asana isn't important in yoga. That just cracks me up. But and what's hilarious is those three sutras, they can give you an incredible knowledge of asana. But you see, to me, every sutra, every one of the 196 are relevant to practice. You see, and this is the thing that I find as an experiencer of practice, is the Yoga Sutras might be exactly what you said, but when I read them, when I read Sutra 117, and then I go out on my mat and I think about what that thing is saying, it helps me deeply. And there's other sutras, like the one about Bhuta Jaya, the victory or command over the elements, and Indriya Jaya, command over the senses. So me, I'm a selector. I pick and choose. I go in there to the Yoga Sutras as a Hatha Yoga robber. I rob those sutras I mine it for gold, Hatha Yoga gold. And never mind what the Yoga Sutras wants me to kill my mind or, right, or transcend thought. Yeah. So anyway, that's a little something. But in terms of the evolution of Ashtanga, okay, and so you understand, Angela, that what I just told you, though, it sets the stage for all of the evolution that I see. Because, so for instance, because Hatha Yoga itself is a greater category, it's a higher up the chain of evolution, then, like, doing some students, no one needs to do the primary series as it's written, per se, right? So every single student needs to customize. So they might do some of the poses of the primary series. And this is good. This is right. This is not deviating from the system, right? And then the use of props. Again, like modifying finding suitable versions. These are all essential for the evolution of Ashtanga. And it gets, there's a lot to it, Angela, and you all, because to me, like the jump back, you just take the classic Ashtanga yoga, jump back and jump through vinyasa, okay? And so that thingamajigger, okay? So people get rigidly stuck on that's what needs to come between poses and sides of poses. And it has to be like that. You lift up, you jump back, you do upward dog, you do downward dog, you jump through. And to me, that's not in the spirit of the vinyasa of this meta-level thinking that I'm talking about. Because what's a more meta level is going, okay, in Ashtanga, they're telling you that instead of when you do Janu Shirshasana A, before you do Marichyasana C, say, you do some little thingamajigger. Okay, it doesn't have to be that exact thingamajigger, but it's something, something that's not just going from this pose to this pose to this pose to this pose. Okay, because that's not vinyasa, right? Whereas many styles, there's nothing in between. You do your pose, and then you do the next pose. But no, not in Ashtanga, no. And so, but what that thingamajigger is, it could be, it's very open-ended. And you could say, at the very least, it has strengthening. It's a strength thing. So you lift up, right? So you understand what I'm saying, Angela, that this is part of the evolution that needs to happen, is that you go from that template of like, yeah, it's this really set thing, and you want to know that set thing really well, and then interpret it, widen it out, go to a different level of thinking that's not so literal, is more creative, and more individualized, has more variety in it, is able to accommodate different circumstances, right? Like injuries or time constraint or genetics or age or all kinds of aptitude, interest level. So many variables are there that need to be accounted for. And you see, here's the thing, why all of this is important, Angela, or one reason, is because what people do is that they either become like these stalwart Ashtangis. I go to Mysore and I only study with authorized teachers. Or they quit. okay? And those are not the only two options, you see? And there's a whole spirit of Ashtanga that, so you can be a very loyal, exemplary Ashtanga student and never do primary or second series. Do you understand? It's a mentality. It's you're trying to extract this certain approach to yoga from that is not dependent on doing a series of poses in a certain order. Okay? That's that. All right. So, I guess that may come to the end of the line. Uh-oh, here we go with somebody else. Okay, all right. So here, I'm going to read her thing. This will be the last one, though. So it's, during my practice, you almost always mention to me a mistake that I make, which is the lack of attention to some things during my transition. So the moment you point it out to me, I manage to connect more deeply and do it better. Okay, so my question is, do you consider that it is just a lack of attention? Because at that moment, I feel like I'm giving 100%, but after your correction, I managed to do it better. You guys, that's the teacher. That's the teacher right there. Right there in a nutshell. Okay, I love that. So if that weren't the case, I wouldn't have a job, Nandini. So she goes, I don't know if it's also a lack of trust, or maybe I can't connect more deep, or maybe I still can't connect more deeply. How can I maintain the attention in each vinyasa throughout my practice? Okay, well, it's just what I said, that a teacher helps you, right? They see what you don't see. And so that's good. But that's not the only answer. So I think, well, so one thing, Nandini, is I think that, see, here's what's hard about it, is that I do think you're onto it, that there's a common theme to it, but it's really challenging to, so it's more easy to be instructed and then to find that isolated instance, right? It's like, so like, because I work it through with you in that very transition. Okay, but then there's a certain trickery involved in the yoga, right? Where we keep repeating the same thing over and over again, but it's given a different, little bit different package or form, right? Because like going into triangle is different than going up into headstand, is different than, jumping to Bhuja Pidasana. But it actually isn't different. That's the thing, is it appears different, but it's not. And so that lapse of attention or that thing that's not happening, it's happening in other poses, but it's much harder to, it can be hard to transfer that from the individual instance that you've been instructed or like now you see. But that's what I would do, is just try to start making that connection. It's like, okay, so I understand it here, but so what does that mean for here, for this transition, right? Like what's the little difference in this other transition that's now tricking me, right, into That's the lapse of attention. And then also, you guys, you understand. See, this is what I want to tell you about. I think it's true of a teacher in general, but I always imagine. Here's what I imagine. So I imagine that, and I don't know what you all do. I have no idea, but I imagine that, you know, like some of you come to class 1 to 3 times a week. And that is a perfect ratio to me. Like even in an ideal world, I wouldn't encourage a student to go to a class every day. I would encourage them to practice by themselves at least half the time. All right? And in those times when you practice by yourself, you really are the decision maker, and you want to take command of that decision. And so, and you're not even, to a certain degree, you're like, oh, David said this, or David told me to do this. But to another degree, a greater degree, you're going, but I see it this way. I want to do it, or I'm called to explore it this way, right? That you fully own your own practice, not the way somebody else told you, but the way you do it, okay? And especially the longer you practice, the more that becomes true, okay? At first, you rely on the teacher more, but as time passes, you explore for yourself more. And then when you come to the class, though, you faithfully work with what the teacher's giving you, you know, and try. And so it's because the teacher, they do have their own agenda, their own bias, their own kind of subjective place they're coming from. And you don't have to 100% take that on. You know what I'm saying? So you don't have to sit there in your practice and go, oh, I'm doing that wrong. It's like maybe it's worth an inquiry, but maybe you're doing just fine. You know, or maybe my emphasis is like, it's good, but it has limits. That's what I'm saying to you. Right? It's not the be-all, end-all. No, what you come up with is the be-all, end-all. Ha ha! Yeah. And of course, any good teacher, right? They're passionate. They're persuasive and emphatic or commanding. But that doesn't mean that that when you leave that session or that room, that I expect you to rigidly follow me, right? No. You're now on your own path of discovery. And I'm a guide, and I hope you can use what I've shown you. But, yeah. All right, guys. So, hope you enjoyed that. I certainly did. And really thank you for joining and giving your attention, and really appreciate you all very, very much, and love that we're sharing this yoga together.